This is a talk from bethinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit bethinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a bethinker to hear all about bethinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. So, this evening, as I said, I'm finishing off a short series. I think it was short. On the subject of epistemology. And what I did in the first lecture was to do an overview of the history of philosophy, one of these grand libris overviews. And in this history of philosophy, I looked at epistemological developments within that flow of history. And I highlighted there two different epistemological systems which have been in conflict with each other throughout the whole of the development of philosophical thought. And there I contrasted the triad with the dyad. The triad has three points in the triangle. Some of you have been arguing with my spelling there. I know it's an Andrew spelling, and I did it on purpose. Three points in the triangle: subject, who's the one who wants to know, object, and there's always a gap between subject and object. And how do we close that gap? That's the epistemological enterprise to try and close the gap between subject and object. And importantly, in the triad, you have this world of ideas. And I've said that this the ideas here are not part of the interlocking system of nature. The world of ideas are part of super nature. When you deal with ideas, in the fullest sense of that word, you are dealing with the supernatural. And we saw in this flow of philosophical history that within the triad, those who have worked within the triad, there's always been epistemological optimism, often far too great an optimism, but it was always thought within the triad that you can come to true understanding and true knowledge. That ideas, the world of ideas, actually bridge the gap between subject and object. And that's because they're not part of the system of nature. And so it can bring the two together. The other system that's been in conflict with the triad is what we call the dyad. And there's only two points in this epistemological system, the subject and the object. And reason here is just part of the interlocking system of nature. It's not part of supernature, it's interlocked. And this has almost always, over time, led to an epistemological pessimism. And that's because ideas are just part of the system of nature, and it just leads to skepticism over the possibility of knowledge. Your thinking processes are totally bound up in the subjectivity of knowing. There's no escape from it. You're just caught up in this circle. And in the end, this undermines the knowing process, and the gap remains between subject and object. Now, in my last lecture, I argued very strongly for this world of ideas and explored it in detail. And I've done this because the world of ideas in a more most postmodern climate is completely out of favor. And if you interact today with modern theology, you'll see that modern theology has no time for systems anymore. Systematic theology is very much out of fashion because whenever you deal with systems, you're dealing with something which is in the world of ideas. But I believe, for reasons I gave last time, that the world of ideas is absolutely critical if we're going to retain the possibility of knowledge. And as we explored this world of ideas, we looked at how sin, it's very important that we take this up, because often within the triad, there's only been this optimism. There's been no sense of how sin impacts it. So as we explored the world of ideas, we looked at how sin has impacted the knowing process. And we saw there that it's caused what I call an epistemic blindness. And though the world of ideas still exists, the rational processes have been vandalized. The rational faculties have been damaged, so we can no longer fully trust them. Before the fall, I think we could trust perfectly what we did within the world of ideas. We no longer can because of this epistemic blindness. And this epistemic blindness means that we need something more in order for there to be true knowledge. Sin has vandalized this world of ideas, so we need something on top of the world of ideas, interjected into the world of ideas if we're going to come to true knowledge. And this something more is, of course, revelation, a special word of knowledge that comes from the outside. And if we didn't have this special word, we would remain forever in epistemic blindness. Now, the moment we raise the issue of special revelation, we bring the concept of faith into the equation. And that's where I want to go tonight in this final lecture. We bring faith into it because special revelation reminds us that there are issues of knowledge which are not available to the unaided reason. The reason standing on its own in the universe is not enough. So the Bible teaches with respect to knowledge. We need something more. And this something more is revelation. The Christian acknowledges that the autonomous reason is not enough. We need revelation, and this makes faith an epistemic necessity in the knowledge enterprise. So Christianity has always, to some degree, often overstressed it, often understressed, as we'll see later, but acknowledged the place of faith in the knowledge enterprise. And throughout the history of philosophy, the relationship between faith and reason has been debated in the whole knowledge process. What is the relationship between the two? And up until Descartes, the two existed together in a relationship that led to knowledge. If you were going to come to true knowledge, you needed both faith and reason. Now, there are a few exceptions to this along the way, but generally, the place of both has always been acknowledged up until Descartes. And the issue throughout the history of philosophy was really at the level of emphasis. Which do you emphasize more, faith or reason? But you never annihilated one against the other. You'd ask which is primary and which is secondary. Is the accent to be on faith or is the accent to be on reason? The point is, both coexisted. So there was always an acknowledgement of the place of reason in the knowledge enterprise. And reason here is looking for coherence, rationally, does the thing make sense that I'm looking at? Is the knowledge claim verifiable by rational thought processes? And the stress here is on what the human being does through the use of the mind. So reason is about the human initiative in the epistemological enterprise. But there's also, and there always has been, an acknowledgement of the place of faith. And faith is simply a human response to someone else's initiative. And this initiative from someone else we call revelation. Something is shown us which we could never have known for ourselves. And faith is our certainty that this other revelation is true. It works together with reason. It says this is true. So it's a human response to revelation. Now it's worth saying here that within the Christian tradition, faith has always had two emphases. There's an epistemological emphasis and a soteriological emphasis. Soteriology is the doctrine or theology of salvation, how one comes to be saved. So on the epistemological side, we're looking at how things are and how we can know that they're true. The soteriological is looking at how salvation is being grasped. And faith has always been applied in slightly different ways to these two things. Thomas Aquinas represents the more epistemological approach to faith, and he gives a great deal of attention to how faith brings us to a knowledge of truth. And truth for Aquinas is defined as the articles of Christian faith. And in the context of these lectures, we're thinking of faith more in this sense. The other emphasis, which is equally important, and these are not mutually opposed to each other, would be represented by Martin Luther. He represents the more soteriological approach to faith, how faith leads us to salvation. And the emphasis on faith here is much more personal. Faith leads to a relationship with Christ. So the Christian tradition has always had these two stresses: faith, more in an epistemological sense, this is the way we're using it tonight, and then faith in terms of salvation. And both of these are very, very important, and they both relate to each other. And I want to briefly highlight that at the end of my lecture. Now, what I want to do in this final lecture is look at the five approaches to the relationship between faith and reason. And all of you here will fit into one or more of these five models. In fact, probably none of you fit purely into one of them. Probably one or two, perhaps three of these will resonate with all of you here. And it's important for you to understand that the model that you work within has major consequences for the way you deal with the knowledge question. And the way you deal with the knowledge question has a huge impact in the way you live your life. A stress I want to make here, that the way we think about knowledge impacts deeply the way we live. These two are not separated. So this is not just abstract theory at the end of the day. It might feel like that in some respects, but it's not. So I want to go through fairly quickly these 5 points here, 5 different models in terms of a relationship between faith and reason. The first is reason against faith. Reason against faith. The Enlightenment made for the conditions that produced a divorce between reason and faith. And those, the two which actually worked together in a harmonious relationship up until that time were severed at the Enlightenment. Locke, John Locke, is well known for a phrase where he says, belief is a persuasion which falls short of knowledge. And Immanuel Kant said, faith beliefs are held on grounds that are subjectively adequate but objectively inadequate. And here we see faith reduced to something very inadequate, inferior to reason. And it's at the Enlightenment that we actually see faith, reason turning against faith and beginning to attack it. Both of those quotes show this undermining of faith and belief. Faith is thought within this model to be inadequate in terms of the knowledge enterprise. Everything must be left to reason. Reason alone can arrive at the truth. It was thought then that faith always falls short of certain knowledge. And the only way to achieve certainties, and that's what epistemology is concerned about, the only way to achieve certainties is to abandon faith and exalt the place of reason. Faith is actually interrupted. The epistemological enterprise always brought us up short. So if we abandon faith, reason turning against faith, and embrace reason alone, then we can come to true knowledge. Now, I believe that this is still how many, many view it today in terms of the epistemological enterprise. All of us, whether we like it or not, are children of the Enlightenment, and it in fact affects our thinking at a very deep level. I think many of us want rational certainties today which are based on reason alone, and we tend to despise the place of faith in the epistemological enterprise. And I see this reflected in so many students who come through Libri today. Now, this divorce between reason and faith can be traced back to Descartes, who is known as the father of modern philosophy. It's interesting that Descartes was a contemporary of Blaise Pascal back in the 17th century. And Pascal is my favorite philosopher, if you can call him that. And he, at the very moment that Descartes was putting forward his views, Pascal saw what it would lead to. Absolutely incredible. It took the rest of the world 300 years to sort of catch up. Pascal saw it when it was happening. Anyway, Descartes constructed a method of coming to truth known as the Cartesian way. The Cartesian way. Now, it's important for us to begin by acknowledging that Descartes was very likely a Christian man. He was very devout Catholic. And this methodology that he constructed was simply a way of trying to overcome the profound skepticism of his own day. That was the milieu of his day. Profound skepticism everywhere. Very much like the moment we live in today. And Descartes was a brilliant man, and he was actually challenged by a Catholic bishop to come up with a method that would overcome skepticism and provide certainty. So this is actually what lies behind what he's attempting to do here. Surrounded by skepticism, and he faces this challenge. How can we overcome all this skepticism and provide absolute certainties for the church and for people who are interested in the church? Now, how did he overcome all this skepticism? What he needed to do, he thought, was to put to one side all those things that were open to doubt. And if you leave to one side all the things that you can doubt, at the end of the day, all you'll be left with is indubitable certainties. Things that can never, ever be doubted. Things that are self-evident. So what Descartes set out to do is to build a structure of knowledge through the processes of reasoning that would have the clarity and indubitability of mathematics. That's what he was trying to do. He was a brilliant mathematician. Once you understand a mathematical equation, it can't be doubted. Now, in order to do this, Descartes had to do two things. First of all, he had to move beyond revelation. There's something about the idea of biblical revelation that doesn't fit into the category of a mathematical equation. You can't make biblical revelation something which has philosophical indubitable certainty, something that can never be doubted. It's never self-evident in a way that can never be doubted. So you have to go beyond revelation, Descartes said. You also have to go beyond faith. That's because faith is a persuasion which falls short of knowledge. So this means faith does not fit the category of certain knowledge. It falls below that. Descartes said there's a kind of knowledge for which one does not have to depend on faith at all. That's certain knowledge. It's based on reason alone. There's another kind of knowledge which is only available by the exercise of faith, but it's a much inferior type of belief. So he's going to move beyond revelation and beyond faith in order to arrive at a knowledge which is indisputable. And so he'll overcome the problem of skepticism. Now, the place Descartes started from was the place of extreme doubt. He starts with the very problem he's trying to overcome. And he doubts absolutely everything, right down to his own existence. That's the most basic thing he can doubt. And that led him to his, I think, therefore I am. Just to doubt my own existence, I have to think. To have that thought, I think, therefore I am. We need to see here that the starting place of indubitable certainty for Descartes was in himself as a thinking person. And from this starting place, he would arrive at certainty. The autonomous human intellect on its own will give the truth. So reason is made king here. And from this certain foundation, every claim to truth would then be put through the critical sieve, open to doubt, and only the indubitable would be retained. And that would be the body of certain knowledge. This could never be doubted. The rest would just be belief and faith. Now, Descartes and those who followed him believed that by adhering to these methods, one could obtain indubitable certainty. And with Newton, Descartes' vision of the world, understood in terms of the indubitable certainties of mathematics, seemed to be vindicated. Newton's model seemed to provide a clue to the understanding of everything from the movement of the stars to the fall of the apple. And it was thought then that the whole universe would be understood with the clarity of mathematics. And here was a model of reality that did not depend on divine revelation or faith. Now, the Enlightenment, with great enthusiasm, built on that foundation. We can call it the foundation of objective knowledge. It was believed that because reason was king, the subjective element had been completely eradicated. And this had led to something which gave undeniable certainties. You see, for the rationalist, where reason is against faith, all truth claims can be divided into two categories. Firstly, those which communicate objective knowledge, that's use of the reason. Secondly, those which express subjective experiences, that's faith. And the Cartesian way is the only way to the former. This is how you come to objective knowledge. This is what science does. It gives objective knowledge. Now, it's here that I believe we need to uncover what I call the myth of objectivity. The myth of objectivity. Because although the Enlightenment built upon this foundation, that if you follow this methodology, the Cartesian way, you'll come to indubitable certainties, which are universally applicable to everyone. No one can deny it. But the fact is, recent thought has correctly shown that there is no such thing as indubitable certainty. And that's simply because you can never remove the subjective factor from our knowledge claims. You can't remove that. You see, all human knowing involves both a human knowing human subject and something that is the object of the subject's inquiry. Subject-object. You never remove this from the knowing process. So the two poles of subject and object are involved in any knowing that takes place, and it always happens together. And that's why Descartes made a huge mistake to create this wide gulf between them. He did this in his bid to create indubitable certainty. He tried to remove this altogether. Now, this thesis has been wonderfully developed by a Hungarian scientist and philosopher called Michael Polanyi in his wonderful book, Personal Knowledge, one of the great things to come out of Hungary. What a hard read, though. It's a very, very difficult read, but it's a fantastic book. And Polanyi shows how this objective-subjective dualism is false. That the title of the book reflects this, personal knowledge. All knowing of reality involves the personal commitment of the knower as a whole person. That's basically what the book's about. And it's a very compelling look at the way science works. It's really a philosophy of science. And Polanyi made a number of important points. Firstly, he shows how scientific learning is acquired by working with and under the direction of those who are already skilled. So scientific learning is not acquired in isolation by the unaided mental processes of the student. The scientist doesn't start as a blank slate. He embodies a tradition. And he said, secondly, that scientists work by indwelling that tradition. So they start with an apprenticeship. They don't start as blank slates. Boom, completely neutral. No, they borrow what's come behind them, and they take that on. And they indwell that tradition. And the assumptions of their apprenticeship become part of their own equipment on which they rely. And actually, this apprenticeship functions for them like the lenses of a pair of glasses. They work with presuppositions. There's no such thing as a sort of a neutral view of the scientist. You borrow this from this tradition, and that's the way you look at reality around you. And in order to make progress as a scientist, you have to trust that tradition. He also said that advances in scientific knowledge are made by recognizing a problem and seeking a solution. And the interesting point he makes here for me is that the recognition of the problem is an awareness which can't be anything more than an intuition. There's just this sense, this inner intuition that there's some pattern or harmony waiting to be found there. And it's fascinating. If you read anything about the life of Albert Einstein, he had the most incredible imagination. He was an intuitive scientist. He kind of blows away the idea of the objective scientist working carefully step by step. He was incredibly imaginative, one of the most remarkable imaginations of our century. And imagination and intuition isn't covered by formal rules. They all involve the personal commitment of the knower. Fourthly, Polanyi said that there's a vast amount in our knowledge which in fact guides our thinking, but which we do not explicitly formulate. Which is basically another way of saying we know far more than we can express. And he called this tacit knowledge. We experience this around Labrie lunch tables when we try to garble out something. And we know much more than we can actually say, although sometimes we try to say more than we can know. And we reveal ourselves quickly there. But for most of us, this is true, tacit knowledge. We know more than we can express. And our formal and explicit knowledge depends upon a vast amount which is not formal and explicit again. And then he made the obvious point in the fifth place that science cannot enable us to understand everything in the visible world. Science is limited. The exhaustive examination of the physical, chemical, and mechanical structures of the machine will never uncover questions like purpose and other metaphysical questions. So science only gives us a one-sided perspective. So any certainties that science does give us are very limited in terms of their scope. And what Polanyi's work does is reflect that there is no such thing as objective knowledge. And he actually undermines pure reason as a way to indubitable certainty. Our subjectivity is always involved. And the reason always reflects the subjective element. And therefore, it's not a way to certain knowledge in terms of the completely verifiable. So the approach of reason against faith is not sufficient to attaining knowledge. Polanyi shows that a kind of faith is implicit in all our knowledge processes. We receive, as it were, the revelation of those who have gone before. It's a form of revelation. We receive that by faith. We indwell it and commit ourselves to it. And on the basis of that, we come to more knowledge. Very simple but devastatingly effective critique. Now, despite the evidence that objectivity, pure objectivity, is a myth, many, many today continue to work within this model. And I believe this is how many Labrie students approach Christianity. They still work within the Cartesian way. It's simply called as rationalism. That means that reason is king for them, and it alone is the foundation of knowledge. And within the Cartesian way, you're constantly applying the critical principle. Everything has to stand up to doubt, which I actually agree with, and then you just put everything through the critical sieve of your reason, and in the end, that will bring you to objective knowledge. You lay aside that which doesn't stand up to the test, and you retain that which does. So you throw out beliefs, and you retain true knowledge. Now, in such an epistemological enterprise, you are left totally in control of the knowledge process. And that's the problem of this for me, because faith always means a degree of risk. And the problem I have with the critical method, the Cartesian way, is that it's so safe because it's all in your hands. Now, I believe this is largely driven by a psychological necessity. We don't like risk today. Risk frightens us. So if we can keep asking all the questions in the Cartesian way, we're safe. Now, the big problem here is that you fail to see that this rests on a starting point which is actually held acritically, i.e. it's held in faith, namely that reason provides objectivity. That's your starting point. Everyone has to find a starting point. That's your starting point if you work within this model. Reason provides objectivity. But to be consistent, that also needs to be subjective to critical questioning. And that's what Polanyi does. He actually subjects that itself to critical questioning. But if you're absolutely committed to it because it's safe, psychologically you won't allow that to happen. It's the one thing you have control of. I, my reason, can find the truth. Now, Nietzsche was the one who saw that reason as a starting point also needed to be questioned in order to be consistent within the Cartesian way. And Nietzsche actually saw where this would lead if it was done honestly. He saw that the critical questioning would actually go on forever and ever and ever. You would always forever be eternally questioning. And that would never lead to anything. You'd become lost in a spiral, I call a Nietzschean circle, always questioning. And again, I think there are many today who actually are prepared to stay with this and to receive the critique of Polanyi and still keep on going with the cycle of eternal questioning, because it means you're still in control. And it also keeps you safe from commitment. You can always remain detached. Someone like Descartes. Descartes was a very detached thinker. You just look at it as it is. That doesn't stand up to the critical sieve. That does. We'll retain that. Detached knowledge. And that's why many are happy to stay in the faith against the reason against faith model. So that's the first model for the relationship between faith and reason. Secondly, faith against reason. And here again, we see a severing of the relationship between faith and reason. These two are meant to operate together. This severs them again. And this position is reached, this model is worked with, usually out of extreme skepticism. We saw this in our overview of the history of philosophy. I call them thinkers of discontinuity. Skepticism with respect to reason becomes so great that the only possibility of knowledge is in revelation. We are so locked into the system of nature that until God breaks through, there can be no knowledge of truth. And this knowledge of truth comes completely from the outside in the form of an existential experience. And all that is necessary here is an act of faith as a response to this revelation. So in this system, reason is completely downplayed and faith is everything. And we actually see this in Kierkegaard's famous leap of faith analogy. It actually pits faith against reason. And the early Karl Barth also occupied a very similar position. The skepticism within the dyad becomes so great that the only way you can come to knowledge is by something dramatic from the outside. This great existential experience. Now, this particular approach has been called fideism, only faith. And a lot of Reformed theology and apologetics, I think, has bought far too much into fideism. In theology, it expresses the idea that the reason is so impaired by sin that it's incapable of any knowledge. Basically, the epistemic blindness is total. So knowledge comes only when revelation breaks through from the outside, and then we just respond in faith. Now, I don't want to spend time here critiquing this model. In my last lecture, I argued very strongly for the world of ideas and the place of reason. I said that to deny this is deny a very important part of reality. But just to say that this model exercises a considerable influence amongst Christians today, very much a return of Barthian thinking. I think the whole post-liberal tradition very much stands within this faith against reason model. Very, very strongly against all worldviews, anything that works with the world of ideas. I think I see it at a different level in many Labrie students who come to Labrie with the don't ask questions, just believe mentality. That's what's being foisted upon them. And I think it's still part of the culture of the church today. Don't ask your questions, just believe. Now, the presupposition behind this mentality is that the Bible is true, which is good. I think it goes a little bit further, that those who preach and teach the Bible have correctly interpreted it. That one's pretty dangerous for me. And we have to receive this teaching without question. That is, we receive it in faith. And to question any belief is to actually exercise a lack of faith. To question is synonymous with unbelief. Behind this logic is the idea that the questions which come from the reason reflect an unwillingness to believe, to have faith. So in this don't ask questions, just believe culture, I think what we see is this whole idea that reason is dangerous. Reason undermines faith. So faith, therefore, has to be against reason. So we have to side with faith and not let reason have a foothold, because if you get reason in there, it always leads to unbelief. So the safest thing is don't ask questions. People who ask questions always seem to come to a greater degree of unfaith, if I can put it like that. So don't ask questions, just believe. Now, what this approach fails to recognize is that all beliefs must be open to doubt. Every single belief has to be open to being questioned. Now, notice it's not we who are questioning here. We've made the commitment, but we're open to another questioning us. We should never be afraid of that. And I believe we have to be open to this because there is no indubitable certainty. There is no absolute proof on which we stand. The basics of our Christianity we receive by faith. And I think this is seen in the writings of Schaeffer. Many misunderstand him here, but Schaeffer was very open to Christianity not being true. Even though he said it a million times, Christianity is true. But to say Christianity is true with integrity is to say that you're open to the falsification of that claim. If you're dealing with Christianity in truth terms, then you have to be open to an argument which may falsify your claim. So if someone comes along with a coherent argument that God doesn't exist, and it's clear that it's just a crazy argument, you'd be a fool to hang on to it. If someone can really come up with a coherent argument that shows that it's not true. Now, Schaeffer never expected anyone to come up with that, and I don't expect anyone to come up with that, but I have to be open. We all have to be open to being questioned with respect to our faith. We're not just clinging to something with a closed mind. Added to this, I think we need to say that openness to doubt, openness to being questioned, is absolutely necessary to the increase of faith. People who have this don't ask questions, just believe, never really go very far with their faith. It's when we allow ourselves to be questioned that we can really grow, we can really develop. It means we're not insulated against risk. And again, it means we are not in control. So you are open to doubt, you're open to being questioned. And then if your belief system stands the test, you grow in your confidence. I have to say that I love it when we have a hardened atheist here at LaBrie who argues very strongly around a lunch table. And for some of you, that's the first time you've really met, in a real way, the arguments of a hardened atheist. And you get really scrambled for a while, you get really shaken, but it's very good for you. Because it's very easy to be brought up in a very cloistered environment where you're never questioned, your faith is never questioned. It doesn't have a chance to grow then. And I see many people begin to fall apart, just sort of, oh no, I come to LaBrie and I'm supposed to strengthen my faith and it's falling apart. Because this person keeps putting all these strong arguments to the table. And in our discussions. But then you let go in a good way and really begin to build. You either let go completely and it falls apart, or it becomes stronger at the end of the day. So in that sense, we have to be open to being questioned. In fact, I think we should see the questions as a form of revelation for us. They come from the outside in order to bring us to a greater level of faith. The point is, this increase takes place when faith is open to the challenge of reason. So when faith is against reason, it actually undermines itself, because reason, these two working together, faith being open to the questions of reason, allows this to grow. So this again is a model that needs to be rejected. The third model is faith over reason. Faith over reason. Now, in this model, we have the operation of both faith and reason. The one isn't annihilating the other here, so they're both in operation. But because faith is over reason, there's a dualism here, because they both exist in different realms. So you've got faith lying reason under there. That's a dualism. And within this model, I have in mind this, that faith is something which you exercise in religious matters. Reason is something that operates in the rest of your life. So it's that sort of a dualism. When it comes to religious matters, you exercise your faith, but the rest of life, your work, doing your Times crossword, science, education, how am I going to build a life? There you use your reason. But this dualism often doesn't directly impact the epistemological enterprise. It doesn't interfere with one's quest for knowledge, per se. But it does cause a type of schizophrenia. Because that's because faith and reason operate independently of one another. And we become stuck with a divided consciousness. Now, this model is actually reflected in the thinking of Kant, the German philosopher, because he actually divided reality into two parts, the noumena and the phenomena. The realm of noumena was that realm which belonged to the empirical perceptions. Sorry, it was beyond the realm of empirical perceptions. So values, things like goodness, love, and beauty, you couldn't test those scientifically. They're beyond that realm. That's the realm of the noumena, the noumenous. We often use this for the supernatural realm. Then there was a realm of phenomena, and that's the realm that you can witness by means of the empirical. You can see how it works. You can perceive it empirically through science. Now, Kant said that reason operates in the realm of the phenomena. Faith operates in the realm of the noumena. So actually, Kantian epistemology is very divided, faith over reason. And that's where you get this division between reason and faith. They're both operating, but they're divided. There's a dualism. And I believe today many of us translate this division into our own lives and the chasm which takes place between the public and private spheres of our lives. The public world we live in is the one of the mega institutions, government, business, education. And this is the world where as human beings, as selves, we feel very anonymous and rather crushed. But it's in this public world that the reason functions supreme. And here, especially in late modernity, everything is about problem solving. Get the job done as efficiently as possible. Use the reason to get the job done. On the other side of the chasm, you have our private worlds. And this, of course, is where the real me functions. Here I can follow through my real interests in life. And faith is just fine in that sphere. In fact, you can believe anything you want within the private sphere. Public sphere, we bring reason, rationality to that as much as we can. In the private sphere, you can do whatever you want. You can mix and jumble it all up. You can be a Buddhist and a Hindu and a Christian all at the same time. It doesn't matter. That's a realm of faith. But woe betide the person who takes faith into the public sphere. There we must use reason alone. There's no place for faith in the public sphere of life. And that, of course, means that Christianity is no longer public truth, because Christianity has been reduced by the modern world to something which is just about faith. It's simply for the private sphere. Now, because the private is most important to most of us, the private sphere of our lives, those of us who are Christians would put faith over reason in terms of importance. But the fact is the two are very divided, and that's where many Christians are today. They live within this model, and in their private worlds their faith operates, but they can't take it out into their public worlds. It's a dualism. The fourth model is this, faith based on reason. Faith based on reason. Now again, in this model, both faith and reason are operational. And actually, the connection between the two of them here is smooth. It's a smooth connection. There's no dualism here. And it works like this. You use your reason, your rational faculties, to figure out what is true. And on the basis of this exercise, you come to the place of faith and belief. So when you've got it straight in your head, then you believe. Reason precedes faith. You could sum it up in the phrase, I know, therefore I believe. I've got it all worked out rationally, so I believe. Now this model is reflected in what is known as the evidentialist approach in apologetics. A classic example of this would be Josh McDowell. In his his famous works, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And there is much good stuff in his work, but he very, very much within the fourth model here. The idea is this. on the basis of the clear evidence at hand, you have to make a faith commitment. So if you look at Volume 1 of Evidence That Demands a Verdict, you look at his section, Chapter 4, Reliability of the Bible. Sort of boom, 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 boom. There's all the evidence for the Bible being reliable. Believe it. Simple. It's interesting, over the last 70 years, many attempts have been made to logically prove the resurrection of Jesus, the most famous of which is probably Frank Morrison's Who Moved the Stone? It's an evidentialist approach. Here's all the evidence. Boom, 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 boom. You have to believe it. Now, there is great value in the rational arguments of the evidentialist tradition. I think they can lend real credibility to the rationality of Christianity, that it really is true. But I believe there are a number of reasons why this is a flawed model for the relationship between faith and reason. And many, many Christians today operate on this one here, but I think it's a flawed model. The first reason is this, that reason never arrives at indubitable certainties. I've already covered this. I've already tried to show that there is no such thing as pure objectivity. We as subjects are always involved in the knowing process. We always bring presuppositions into the knowing process. We never start as blank slates. We bring our backgrounds with us, and it's impossible to have pure objectivity. And that means it is wrong to suppose that faith can ever rest on something which is absolutely verifiable. That just doesn't exist. And that's why clever people can very easily shoot holes through this type of apologetic approach. It can always be undermined. So this means that if reason is the whole basis for the act of faith, our faith is resting on a flawed foundation. The heart of Christianity is in the assertion that Jesus is Lord, and that reflects the fact that Jesus is God. Jesus is the Son of God. He shares all the attributes of God. He is God. Now, to say that that is an indubitable truth for which I have a rational proof is quite foolish. Quite foolish. I think there are many, many good reasons why we can believe that in faith. Reasonable means it's based on the rational. But to say that you have a proof for that is quite wrong. We cannot have absolute proofs on which our faith can rest. And because of this, remember, they always have to be open to being questioned. Now, the faith based on reason model tends to deny this. There's no being open to being questioned at all. It's just, boom, there it is. I mean, you're stupid if you can't see it. I'm overstating the case, but I think that often is how it's put to us. I think it's also flawed, secondly, because this model leaves the epistemological enterprise totally in our hands. Because we believe in a watertight rational argument leading to indubitable certainty, we remain in the driving seat. The whole thing rests with us. So with our reason, which takes hold of the proofs, and then we believe. And this makes faith an almost risk-free thing. You can't lose. That's not how it is. There's always a degree of risk when it comes to our faith. God wants to empty our hands. He wants to unsettle us. Our problem is that we want to be in control. We have to let go of control. In my last lecture, I tried to show you that both in the epistemological enterprise, God both asks the questions and he gives the answers. The whole thing is a God-shaped enterprise. And my concern with this model here is that it's a very human-shaped enterprise. I come up with all the answers and I disbelieve. Even if those answers are based in revelation, it's still working it out. My third criticism of it is this, that this model cannot avoid circularity. This model cannot avoid circularity. I believe evidentialism, as an apologetic methodology, ultimately rests on the claims of the Bible. It's the Bible that contains the claim that Jesus is the Son of God. And that is why the ultimate project of evidentialism has to center on the Bible. You have to prove that the Bible really is a supernatural revelation from God. Now, although there are reasons which point to the trustworthiness of that extraordinary claim, I don't think it's a daft thing to believe that the Bible is the Word of God. There are many reasonable arguments that lead us in that direction. There is no proof for it. And at the end of the day, we believe the Bible is the Word of God because the Bible says it's the Word of God. It doesn't set an elaborate proof. It just says it's the Word of God. It just states it. And that is a circular argument that does not satisfy the desire for rational certainty. It's something which is accepted by faith. And I believe that it's this that is the ultimate undermining of the model, that it cannot avoid circularity as hard as it tries, and I think that is ultimately what undermines it. The fifth and final model is reason based on faith. That was Josh's way of putting it, or back to this famous phrase, faith seeking understanding. Faith seeking understanding. And I believe this is the correct epistemological model that we need to work within. The 11th century theologian and philosopher Anselm of Canterbury gave expression to the proper relationship between faith and reason in two phrases which are linked with his name. Fides quaerens intellectum, faith seeking understanding, and then credo eu intellectum, I believe in order that I might understand. I believe in order that I might understand. And this reflects the insight that faith comes before understanding, but the content of that faith is rational. I believe it establishes the priority of faith over reason while asserting the entire reasonableness of faith. This isn't a leap in the dark. Faith is reasonable. Faith has priority over reason, but faith is entirely reasonable. Now note here that it's not that faith should seek understanding, but that it must seek understanding. True understanding is always preceded by faith. And that is what Polanyi demonstrates so effectively in his work. We cannot arrive at knowledge until we first make a commitment to a starting point. One of the main things he says. So in science, you need to make a starting point, or make a commitment to a starting point, which would be a tradition. Because we never start with a blank slate. Now that commitment to an apprenticeship that you've gone through, standing in the tradition of a scientific flow of ideas, that commitment is always an act of faith. Polanyi's point. Science, inherent to science, is faith. So it's not a case of committing when we know. No, in order to know, we have to first make the commitment to that body of knowledge. Now that's an act of faith, making the commitment to it, responding to the knowledge of others. Now having made that commitment, we can always break out of it. You can always say Einstein was a fool and didn't have a clue what he was talking about, if you can come up with good evidence for that. So if the knowledge proves false, once you've made the commitment, you can get out. Remember, we are always open to being questioned, because there's no such thing as indubitable certainty. But the fact is, all knowledge involves faith, faith commitment. Now that faith commitment means that knowledge is never detached. And it makes knowing a form of activity which includes the whole person. This is the biblical understanding of knowledge, that it's a full-bodied thing. Because it requires commitment of the whole person. That means there's never a detached way of coming to knowledge. So we have to commit ourselves with mind and heart and body to the presuppositions of another. It's a choice we make. And that's exactly how it works with respect to Christianity. You can never, ever, ever come to a real knowledge of Christianity until you first make a full-body commitment. Faith comes first. Now, you make that commitment on the basis that it looks reasonable. So it's not a blind leap into something which is nonsense. If Christianity looks like nonsense, you don't make the commitment. So you begin to look at it. And you think, well, it looks reasonable. And then you make the commitment. It's a choice to respond fully to the claims of Christianity. But the fact is, you will never know it is true until you commit. That's my point. And I think here we meet the difficulty. Because so many today find commitment almost impossible. We become so detached. We don't believe in anything, we don't know anything. And this lack of commitment is reflected in an apathy and an indifference, a passivity. And we will never, ever come to a knowledge of anything unless we are committed to it. The faith commitment comes first. It precedes the understanding. That's what this reflects. And I think this detachment, which is playing it safe, committing ourselves to nothing, reflects pride. You want to be in control. You're not willing to act in faith because it'll take you out of the center of the enterprise. It'll make you vulnerable to questions, and you'd rather be doing all the questioning. It also reflects a fear, the risk of faith commitment. What if it all goes wrong? It's safer to stay detached. I don't want to get disappointed again. But I'm saying faith is absolutely necessary to the epistemological enterprise. There is no knowledge without the faith commitment. And I want to finish here by saying that this same faith commitment is also necessary to salvation. Salvation is found only in a personal relationship to Jesus Christ. And that personal relationship to Christ is found only in a faith commitment. And that faith means letting go of your agenda, allowing Him to question you. Most importantly, it means a total commitment to Him. His one word to us is, follow me. That's what it means to be a Christian. Jesus says, follow me. And until we make that commitment to follow Him, we'll never know Him. Again, faith comes first, then the personal knowledge. Personal knowledge comes after the act of faith. And that faith is not detached. It's a totally engaged commitment. That is the only way to salvation. So I believe of all the models outlined here, this is the only one that leads to true knowledge. This is the only one which is correct in terms of the epistemological enterprise. Faith seeking understanding. Okay, let's leave it there. We can have some questions now, feedback. Any points of clarification, Tony? And evidence. It does, but what is fascinating for me that Jesus immediately goes on and says, blessed are those who have not seen but believe. So he actually gives Thomas an evidence there, and at the same time as he gives it, he rebukes them. And so there's going to be a whole community of people throughout history who won't have this evidence and will believe just on the basis of the revelation, which is a step of faith. And there are times when the Lord will provide evidences. You see that in the Bible. I think that's often the way He deals with us occasionally the way He deals with us as individuals. But I would say occasionally is very rare. So that's how I'd handle the Thomas passage. Evidentialists go to that, and they use that as their kind of foundation stone. But I think what follows it is very important. Okay?
Think of something about their fifth option, and that you think of, isn't that smart question? I'm curious to know actually, did you arrive at that conclusion through reason or through faith?
Through reason. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. For me, it's a very reasonable thing to come to this. Because the last thing I'm doing, in a sense, the bulk of the series has been arguing for the place of reason as we become more and more irrational. So it's not that I have a problem with reason. I have a problem with rationalism, when reason is thought to be the only way that we can come to knowledge. Then we have the problem. When I come to revelation, and the moment I come to revelation, as I said, I'm forced to think about faith, because accepting the Bible as revelation, well, to be honest, accepting something within the scientific tradition as revelation, as I said, demands a sort of faith commitment. So I'm not coming up with anything here. I'm going to the biblical revelation. The biblical revelation establishes faith as the only way to coming to God. It's actually very harsh on my reason in terms of it being able to do that in an unaided fashion. Autonomous reason cannot come to God. So I would say that this is a biblical model. And so I'm receiving that model on the basis of the Bible. And it's interesting, Anselm was the one who put it in this phrase, and I believe, then the other one, I believe in order that I might know. But the early church fathers, this Augustine, this is very much the epistemological framework within which he stood. I think if you start with the Bible, you acknowledge the limitations of human reason, you there are accepting faith. But you haven't arrived at it yourself. The Bible has told you those limitations to your reason. Your reason is affected by sin. Every part of you is damaged by sin. So it's not that this was sort of constructed in a clever, reasonable way. I'd say to accept this takes great humility. This one here is the one that's most appealing in some respects, because it grants most to the human intellectual process. In some respects, this grants the least. But the thing I like about it is that there's still a connection. Both are still there. Well, given that a faith commitment is a full-bodied thing, by full-bodied I mean it demands every part of our humanity, it involves the intellect, but it actually goes far beyond it. So I that's why I like Pliny's date, personal knowledge. So even for science, his philosophy of science didn't say it's this detached kind of pure cerebral thing. The scientist actually has to commit fully to this tradition he inhabits. And in that commitment of pursuing the boundaries of knowledge even further, every part of him is involved. So that understanding includes the intellect, but I think it would go on. Now, for Christianity, for Christians, that actually, and this was Anselm was a Christian, that understanding is ultimately the understanding of God, I would say. It's the knowledge of God, which is a personal knowledge, which is a relationship. And that's why, just at the very end, very briefly, I introduced the more salvific idea of faith in Jesus Christ. He says, follow me. We respond to that. We make a commitment to follow him. And in that, we come to understand him more. So in John 8:31, Jesus says, be my disciples, follow me. After that, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Do you want to come back on that some more? Yeah. Because this whole series has been dealing with a theory of knowledge. But I've been calling for a totally committed approach to knowledge rather than a detached one. A purely theoretical view of coming to knowledge. And this has been a theoretical series, but a commitment, a personal commitment, is much more than just theoretical. And actually, when you really believe in the world of ideas that I've been arguing for, understanding there is not just a cerebral sort of, here, let me give you five propositions. It's something which touches life so deeply. When we engage in a good lunchtime discussion, you know, for me, if it's only theoretical, it's been useless. But there's a sense in a good lunchtime discussion that we're dealing with stuff here that can change the world. Understanding involves that. It's going to touch life very, very deeply. My worry going back to this one, as I said, the evidentialist approach, is it's too easy to convert people to worldviews. And I have to say, in my ministry, I have spent too much time doing that. And there have been people who've been to the Brie and then left the Brie, very committed to a Christian worldview, who hadn't encountered the personal the Christ at all personally. They hadn't encountered God personally. And that's my worry here, that you can easily just, here's a worldview, blah, 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 and there it is. This one here, you start with faith. And that faith is ultimately in God. When you deal with the Bible as revelation, you know, the revelation of who. And so I think this one here, this is a much more humbling one in terms of our evangelism. We're not saying there's no answers. I think Christianity is totally reasonable, right down to the Trinity and the Incarnation, mind-boggling mysteries, but they're still very reasonable to me. There's no mathematical formulas that deal with them, but they're very reasonable. So it's not undermining the reasonableness of things, but it's also acknowledging limitations, that we need revelation. And I think it's the most reasonable thing in the world to actually acknowledge mystery, that there are things which are beyond the confines of our understanding. Take us beyond. There are limitations to our knowledge. So I think it would have a profound effect on our evangelism, just in terms of the way we approach people. And Jesus Christ didn't go around giving neat, philosophically packaged answers. He just said, believe in me, follow me. He was constantly calling for a commitment. And at the end of the day, this one here is asking for some kind of a surrender. It's a reasonable surrender, but we're asking for a surrender. I say it again, trembling, because I know lots of people in this position. There'll be lots of people in hell who've worked within this model. They've got all the right answers, but they haven't made the commitment that's necessary. I also feel that today, this is increasingly important, because I meet lots and lots here coming through Labrie, who are in what I call this Nietzschean spiral, who are constantly questioning and who are unprepared to find a starting point, a reasonable starting point. And that faith preceding understanding here says there has to be a starting point. Choose it. What's it going to be? You can't keep questioning forever. You can, but that'll mean you're committed to nothing. So as long as you remain in that Nietzschean spiral, you're never committed. Always, always questioning. That's not faith. This here demands that we start with something. And I'd rather people make a faith commitment to granny bashing than keeping in the circle forever. I honestly mean this, and I recognize the implications of it. I'd rather someone was committed to Satanism than just detached, going round and round and round forever. It's just, that's not how we're meant to live. So today, I'm encouraged whenever I see a faith commitment to anything. Now, I believe, and this relates a little bit to my lecture on Friday, this passivity we have to do, this fear of taking responsibility. Many, many people today are terrified of making a commitment to anything because of the risks involved. And it makes them very, very passive. And it's a rare thing when you see someone who really passionately believes in something. This demands that. A relationship with God demands nothing less than a full-bodied commitment. Jesus said you can't sort of sit on the fence and go a little bit. It's all or nothing. Now, I say to people, do you think it's reasonable? Is there anything about Christianity which to you is just totally bizarre and crazy? And if they say no, I say, well, go for it. Just throw yourself in. Go for it. Make a reasonable faith commitment. You can always back out. If you go along and you see that God is not faithful to his promises, which is the main way we come to understanding, faith seeking understanding, is actually testing the promises of God. These promises of God which actually meant to become part of our reality, the reality of our existence. He makes these promises on the basis that we in faith respond to those promises. As he fulfills his promises towards us, we come to greater understanding of him. But unless we make that faith commitment, we'll never reach this.
Yes. surviving life, the whole person.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that was, would you say what I mean? Where do you
see the divide is very clear in those two?
Yeah.
There, I just talked about a dualism that they're actually split. Where do you see the split here? I said that faith seeking understanding should be a reasonable faith. That's not a leap in the dark. That's a reasonable faith. You make the commitment based on what you can see and what you know. But until you actually really step into it, you won't come to a certainty. So, but I would say they're connected there. Right. That's interesting.
Yes.
Why is that? Most people would see that as the... Well, I should ask you, but...
I guess while at the university, I was completely 4 years away. I spent the last 4 years trying to... I called it an illusion of being specialised people, but I did that in all the time in the illusion of being
through reason alone, or would you?
The other part of it, just where I see it, and I spent some of that hopefully in class. Reason alone takes yourself. That almost wouldn't destroy God, it would take you to an answer.
Tacit knowledge.
I spent a lot of time on thought. And I believe that's the way God set things up. And I'm not sure what's valuable about the child life. I guess it's the part of it to do with choosing the foolish things as well to shame you are.
Yeah, we all do. I'm with everything you say, as long as you didn't take the child likeness to my just believe and don't ask questions. That's helpful. But I guess I just want to argue that I don't think there is a separation between both of these. There is a connection between the two. That's a false connection. But I really think the two are linked here. And that's the important thing, is I want to go back to a pre-modern, Bob's going to groan here, a pre-modern relationship of reason and faith where these two were connected. I think the devastation of the Enlightenment was this separation.
And
I've argued for the priority of faith over reason, but I remember that saying, but this faith is entirely reasonable. But, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but you're not going back and pitting them against each other, quite the opposite. So there is a relationship still between them.
Yeah. Lately, I've been really interested in how setting up divisions between things is actually reduced. And so, willing to say if I was wrong, I would say that it was a necessary step in the kind of childhood of philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I
father then had the mesh degree and the sense that he connected with being young.
Anybody want to comment any of that, or did you have another question? Sorry. Yeah. Faith to me, we have to be very careful with simple definitions. Sometimes we usually destroy something with a simple definition. But faith for me is simply a response to a revelation. Response to something which is given outside of ourselves. Descartes wanted no revelation, all had to start from within himself. That's the word, I think, therefore I am. That's the starting point, that's the foundation there. No faith there at all. But faith is, no, I receive the revelation of another. And I act on the basis of that. So I want to say, at one level, I don't want to bring the supernatural element right away. Polanyi, in his philosophy of science, shows the place of faith in science. That is, no one starts completely blank. No one. Something's always been handed on. There's always some presupposition of the culture in which you're acting, which you're committed to as you engage in your scientific inquiry. That's a form of revelation. I said even the question of another person is a form of revelation. It's something which comes from the outside, which challenges you, and you respond to that. And that response, if it's the right response, I think can come bring an increase of reasonable faith. So that's my simple definition. It's a response to the revelation of another. And faith is something we exercise all the time. Then there's, if you like, the supernatural faith, which is at the heart of Christianity. And your question is, where does that come from? And that raises a question or two, doesn't it? An issue or two. I believe it is the gift of God at the end of the day. I do believe it's the gift of God. But here, we have to go back, and I just touched on this briefly, we're covering so much material here. I said in Christianity, or the history of Christian thought, you've got two different emphases with respect to faith. You've got the epistemological emphasis, and I cited Thomas Aquinas as an example of someone who talked about faith more in these terms. And then you've got faith in the terms that Martin Luther used it. And for him, it was all about faith is connected with salvation. And I think they're both very, very important. I think there's actually a connection between the two also. When it comes to faith, as Martin Luther talked about it, and he never used a term at all in this sort of a sense. It was always in terms of how one comes to a personal knowledge of God. There especially, I think it is the gift of God. It is supernaturally imparted. That's what I believe the Bible teaches.
I was going to ask, do you think the postmodern mind lends itself more to number five or less, or more to one of the others? Is there some encouragement in that?
Well, everyone's different, but I actually, in my illustration for the first model, the constant questioning, that's a very postmodern stance to take. And people have argued for years now that postmodernism is very irrational. But I actually don't see it. I think postmodernism is hyper-rational. That it is so committed to rationality. And in that sense, the language of postmodernity and postmodernism somewhat troubles me, as if there's this quantum leap between modernism and postmodernism. I think, in many respects, postmodernity and postmodernism is just an exaggeration of modernistic tendencies, just sped up to a phenomenal degree. Now there is a disjunction between the two, especially going to look at linguistic theory. There you see some huge shifts. But I don't think the one is a quantum leap. It's still an extension of the other. But when you look at deconstruction as part of postmodern methodology, it's just question everything. Look at the text. Question. Try and get beneath it. But you never will. You can just ask a million questions. Look at history. Just ask a million questions. And for me, postmodernism is an ideology, if you can call it that, which doesn't want to make a commitment to anything. Always, always questioning. So in many respects, I actually see in terms of this relationship that it fits strongly here, and this is the Enlightenment model. It's just the way it's done that. It doesn't really believe that reason will come up with truth, but it's still no way. We don't really want faith. But we don't believe there's a starting point, so we're just going to enter the Nietzschean spiral. So it's very Nietzschean in that sense. But Nietzsche didn't provide another alternative, except his will to power. I mean, there.
Well, I don't know. I guess I'm seeing a different part, maybe a smaller part. I'm not one to be able to define it. I'm an expert on it, but there's a lot of Eastern thought that seems to me lends itself a lot more to number five than it does to number one.
Yeah, I can see where you get that. I can. I'm thinking more of postmodern theory at a theoretical level. When you look at what postmodernism is doing, I still think it's in this model here. But in terms of the way it's played out today, sort of, you know, pick and mix spirituality, you know, faith. Yeah, faith seems to be in. But I would actually say it's not faith commitment. It's not a real commitment to these things. It's very, very playful. It's still very non-detached. But it's a very good question, and I need to think about that some more. Bob?
Well, this is a comment rather than a question, but I'm just going to make a point. I was looking at those 5 points there, and I thought, you know, four is me, based on experiences and based on the influence and guidance of people that I respected.
Mm-hmm.
I lock on to faith.
Mm-hmm.
Having done that, the reading started,
mm-hmm.
and I started to try and back up that faith by logical reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And we have done quite well on that subject, but I realise that there are many questions that you can't answer through reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to answer them through reasons is to say that one is not in a position to come up with the answer yet.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one day in one's life, or maybe later on, the answers will come.
Mm-hmm.
But then listening to what you're saying, I find that four and five are intertwined, and it may be that when one reaches the point where you can't come up with the answers, or there are the holes in your reasoning, it's faith is taking over,
mm-hmm.
and that if you simply faith, seeking understanding.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I think you're right. We have to remember that this relationship between faith and reason is part of a series I've done on epistemology. When it comes to epistemology as a theory of knowledge, it's not, I think it might be true. You're looking for something which is certain, you can really, really believe in. And that's a very important background to all of this. And this is where perhaps it hasn't worked brilliantly tonight because all the background to this lies in my other lectures. But it's very important to have that background. That philosophically, there's no questions for is it, isn't an epistemology. We want a theory of knowledge. How do I know that what I believe really is true? How do I know that for certain? And I'm saying that faith comes into it somewhere. Even the model, this first model here, or the second one, the one has to acknowledge the other. And there's no philosopher, even modern philosopher, who can ignore faith altogether. So the two are there. So I like what you said, but it's just remembering that it's within the basis of how do I come to certain knowledge. And I'm saying starting with reason alone, we never come to any indubitable certainty. Everything could be undermined. And I often say this to people I'm tutoring, who always have one more question which actually keeps them from a commitment. And they can always find one more. There's always one more you can find to keep yourself going in the circle forever. You don't have to be brilliant to be able to find one more question which actually legitimately questions Christianity. You can always help you keep yourself there. And that, I understand it, but there I can weep sometimes, literally weep. It's more seeing psychologically what's going on. Just this continual question to keep themselves from commitment. They do that with respect to everything. It's why they will find it hard to get married, many of you. There's always one more question to, oh, maybe this isn't the right person. It just keeps one so passive and detached.
You said that you believe that your faith is a reasonable faith, but it seems, first of all, that you have to take that leap of faith and then start reasoning about it afterwards. I call you to Christianity, just accept it right now, and then once you get into it, you'll realize that it does make a lot of sense. I found that in a lot of ways, that we're always going to defend what we believe just to keep our own security, first of all. If you're sort of just on the other pole on Jerry, but I think Jerry's question is something where the fact that, yes, you do take that leap of faith first, and then you just find a reason everything else to make sure it does make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, okay, I put my faith in Christianity right now, and not in the sense that I'm eternally secure, but I'm going to say yes, Jesus is God and things like that, and then now I'm going to try to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have to put my faith in Jesus Christ. You say, I need faith for salvation, okay. I put my faith in Jesus, and now I'm just going to try to prove if it's correct, and if somehow I just become so hampered later on in life, I'm just going to drop it. Because I don't have the answers for it anymore, and I don't know why I really put my faith in Jesus anyway, except for somebody said it was reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this also goes back to the Dallas question back here on the Holy Spirit and salvation.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my first view is, and I'm trying to incorporate this somehow, that is totally a divine work within an individual, that it is only by God's grace that you will receive this faith. And I can't tell you to receive it. God is going to convince you of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't really tell you to your faith in Jesus Christ, because unless you are possessed by the Holy Spirit, you're truly not going to understand it to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And so how can I say to someone, put your faith in Jesus, in that sense?
That's great. You've raised lots of issues there. Make sure we pick up all the threads, because they are important.
Okay. So first of all, is the idea what I seem to see you as saying as your first faith starts off as a leap of faith. That's what I'm seeing you say.
Yeah.
And then you take the leap of faith, and then you reason it out afterwards,
mm-hmm.
which I think ties into the earlier point.
I at one level, I'm happy to go with the terminology of leap. At another, I'm not. And again, this came earlier on in the series. There's a whole existentialist stream in theology today, which I find very, very worrying. It just sort of bypassed the rational altogether. And so the leap of faith terminology very much belongs to the existentialist. So I'd rather avoid that. What we're dealing with here is a starting point. That all knowledge demands a starting point. And that starting point can never be found through rationalization alone. That is, you will never find a starting point by using the Cartesian way and saying, ah, there's the foundation. This is known as foundationalism. And there's a lot of Christianity today which is foundationalistic, as in it says you can find a starting point which has indubitable certainty about it. And that I deny. I do not think that is true. But the fact is, we do need a starting point to go anywhere, to go to a deeper level of understanding. We have to have a starting point. For Christianity, that is Jesus Christ. Now, I think it is a reasonable thing to make Jesus Christ the starting point. The old English Puritans used to talk about launching out on Christ. I quite like that, sort of launching out. Now, that's not sort of a, okay, boom, let's see if this raft floats. It's, you look at the evidence, but there's no proof There is no absolute proof that Jesus was the Son of God, who he is, who he says he was. And I think there are good reasons for believing that, but I cannot have it in a way that is not open to falsification.
Sure, so that leaves you open to point of report, and you consider that.
Yeah.
The evidence of the
expression. So faith leading, reason leading to faith seeking understanding. You're saying the model looks more like that. But I've already said that.
No, I'm saying your faith in Jesus, you're saying that you're not on this raft because of the claims of Jesus. And so, first of all, you can reason to do what you think of Jesus. Instead of being on the raft and saying, okay.
But I think that goes back to what
Andrew
was saying, whether they're more connected than that. You can't separate them.
Mm-hmm. I guess which one first is what I'm thinking.
Well, again, they are extremely connected, but faith is finding the starting point. Now, you can do lots of thinking before you come to your starting point. And that's why I used towards the end of my lecture the terminology faith commitment. Faith is a commitment. It's sort of a, boom, it's not detached any longer. This is where the full body thing comes in. It's sort of, boom, Jesus is the Son of God. Now, I'm going to live that out. I'm going to live on the basis of that. I'm going to live out the implications of that. You've made a commitment. That's what the scientist does. Sort of looks at this tradition and he says, whoa, boom, and he goes, yes, and he's going to take it further. And that is the starting point of faith. Now, just to get to the tradition, you've got to use your reason, understand your scientific tradition. And then you make that commitment.
Okay, I don't see that point that you just made. How do you really get Christianity? You have to look at your tradition first.
Well, I can't commit to Jesus Christ until I know what those signifiers communicate. What actually is embodied within the signifier of Jesus Christ? What's the content to those words? The original Apostles' Creed is three words: Jesus is Lord. Now that there's enough content there to write 300 volumes. And it's incredible what's right there. Now, I don't have to read the 300 volumes, but I need to know something about what is involved in that statement before I say yes, make that faith commitment. And I'm saying, as a result of making that faith commitment, I will come to the epistemology we're dealing with certainty. I'm saying, having made that step of faith, I will come to certainty. It's not, boom, oh, now I know who you are. Okay, we're going to walk together. It's, okay, this is who he says it is, faith. That leads to understanding. That's what Jesus said in John 8:31. Follow me. After that, you will know the truth. The following comes first. Now, when Jesus said to Andrew and